It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret. Late last month, President Trump signed an executive order on homelessness that would make it easier for states to remove unhoused people from encampments on streets. It also encourages civil commitment in some cases for people who are experiencing homelessness and have mental illnesses, and it makes room for this to happen without their consent. That's just one of several federal actions lately that the Wisconsin Board for People with Developmental Disabilities says will have disproportionate negative effects on people with disabilities. Tammy Jackson is with us, public policy analyst at the Wisconsin Board for People with Developmental Disabilities. Tammy, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Thank you for having me.
Let's start with that executive order on homelessness. Your organization released a statement expressing a concern about many of the provisions. What was your first reaction when you made your way through that?
Well, the first reaction was that this order really is rooted in very old ideas and assumptions, and they take us back to outdated policies that were abandoned for very good reason. And my second reaction was, this really doesn't match who we know to be part of the homeless population. It really shows a lack of understanding of who is homeless right now in our state and across the country.
What do you mean by that? What is the reality of homelessness that you think is being missed here?
Well, I'm going to focus on four populations. One of the fastest populations of people becoming homeless are actually older adults and people with disabilities for some of the same reasons. Many folks who are on fixed incomes, maybe because they've worked their whole lives and have retired or are working as much as they can, but are on a program like Medicaid that requires you to stay under a certain level of income and assets, they really don't have a lot of flexibility in their budgets. So as rents go up or food costs or medications go up or their marketplace premiums go up, the amount of money they have to cover all those things soon becomes not enough. And that we see as a major reason why many older adults are becoming homeless for the first time and why many people with disabilities are also losing housing. And of course, if you're a person who needs accessible, affordable housing because you have mobility equipment or other needs, that's an even, there's even less of that housing available. Caregivers are also a factor in a growing rate of homelessness. When family members move in with somebody who needs care, sometimes they aren't on the lease or the deed. And if that person dies, all of a sudden that person has no place to live. And the other big and probably fastest growing homeless population are families. Again, for many of the same reasons, these are working people who are not earning enough to keep up with rent and maybe can't afford childcare, and they are losing their ability to stay housed.
The other provision in this executive order encourages states and local governments to make more use of some kind of civil commitment, involuntarily committing people to institutions. What do you see in that? What, as described in this order, how would that even work?
Well, that's a great question. First of all, no one is immune from mental illness. So it really does feel like if you're in the wrong place at the wrong time, you could become subject to this. And it is unclear who makes the decision of who has a visible mental illness or something that looks like substance abuse. Is that a bystander? Is it law enforcement? And of course, who is visibly mentally ill is also a judgment call. And one of the things that we worry about with many people with disabilities and older adults as well is there are lots of behaviors that people have that may not be in any way part of mental illness, but a part of a disability. Behaviors like stemming or a gait that is different, slurred speech, tremors, those can all be the result of medication reactions or part of a disability. And some people take longer to process, to understand communication, or take longer to communicate. So we do feel like there's a lot of subjectivity in terms of how do you determine whether somebody has something that somebody assumes is a mental illness or a substance abuse, and then what that allows the state to come in and do if they have that perception.
And finally, this executive order targets housing first policies that say, hey, let's get somebody into, like it says, housing first, and then try to see to issues like mental health and substance abuse. This very strongly pushes back against that. This could affect funding for state and local governments. What does that mean, especially for people with disabilities who you work with in Wisconsin?
Well, I think in our population, we really have the lived experience of what mass institutionalization as a policy approach has meant to individuals, families, and to communities. It's simply not a solution. It creates new problems. Forcibly taking away people's rights and putting them into institutions is demonstrably not effective. It's not treatment. It doesn't change the underlying causes of homelessness. And civil commitment is a really big deal. There's a reason it's a court-involved process, because it's the state deciding to restrict somebody's freedom and take you and keep you in a place and decide if and when to let you out. So I can't underscore the seriousness of that as a policy approach and what it could mean if it was applied to somebody that you loved or to yourself.
We're talking about how federal policy and funding changes could affect the population of people with disabilities here in Wisconsin. Tammy Jackson with us, public policy analyst and legislative liaison for the Wisconsin Board for People with Developmental Disabilities. We've been focusing on the executive order. We also have major funding changes in this bill that just passed Congress last month, and Medicaid changes, one of those. Mm-hmm. What kind of changes are you seeing there that have you concerned here in Wisconsin?
Well, the reconciliation bill did several major cuts. First of all, it took about $1 trillion over the next 10 years out of Medicaid. And people across the country are very concerned about what that will mean for state budgets and creation of state budget holes, and what it will mean for people who rely on Medicaid for health and long-term care. There were also cuts proposed to SNAP, which is the food assistance program, and some changes to the ACA marketplaces that will likely result in higher premiums, both because the subsidies were not extended and changes in the bill. So we really have kind of a perfect storm for people who are on fixed incomes and who are worried about rising costs and keeping their care. The federal policy changes, this is one change among many that really have folks concerned who may be kind of working and piecing together and, you know, parts of various assistance programs to stay afloat. And for many people, especially those on Medicaid, they may rely on Medicaid and food assistance and housing vouchers to create a life that is stable. And right now, multiple aspects of those programs are in danger of becoming cut, which really leads to a big population of people who's kind of getting hit from all sides at the same time.
Are you getting a lot of questions at your organization from people, from caregivers, from local nonprofits about just sorting through all the things that are changing here?
There is a tremendous amount of uncertainty, across the board. And I would say that we are hearing daily from people with disabilities and caregivers, many of whom rely on a Medicaid program for their health care themselves, both paid caregivers and unpaid family caregivers, who are really uncertain about, what this means for them. They've grown to rely on these programs being fairly stable, and that is not what it feels like to them right now. And I do think that a lot of the folks that we work with daily are saying, hey, if I get any less help than I have right now, the house of cards tumbles down. And they're very aware of what it would mean to them and their lives and their families if anything changes and they ended up getting less care and less help than they have now.
On a practical level, the house of cards tumbling, what would that mean? Does that mean stopping medications, losing housing? What are some of the consequences you're worried about here?
Yeah, I think a lot of families are worried, about all of those things, frankly. You know, will I lose my health care? If I have a reduction in my food assistance, what does that mean that I, you know, will I be able to eat? You know, if I'm on a fixed income and my supports or my costs change, do I lose my housing? And for many people in our population, you know, we have lots of folks who need stable, reliable care over a long period of time. And we have a lot of family caregivers who are providing most of that care and who are aging. So for our population, it also really is a future worry of not only what happens tomorrow and next month, but next year and the next 5 years. And folks are really, really concerned that the lives that they have built are potentially going to be frittered away. And we have many, many people with disabilities who are saying, if I get less help than I have now, I'm going to end up in an institution, which is exactly the place they don't want to be.
In our last minute or so, for someone who's listening, who has a developmental disability or is a family or other caregiver for them, and they have so many question marks right now, where do you recommend they start just to figure out what these changes mean for them?
I think that we're in a prolonged period where we aren't going to know answers. Part of what the bill requires is for the federal agency, the Centers for Medicaid Services, to come up with a rule to tell states how to do certain things. And that isn't going to be out until next June. So right now, things are stable. The state budget passed the cost to continue for Medicaid. And we're in this kind of wait and see period. People should keep their contact information up to date with our Wisconsin Department of Health Services, so that when we start understanding more about what changes are required and there starts to be a lot of communication about that, people will be primed to get that and receive that.
And we'll leave it there. Tammy, thanks for joining us today.
You bet. Thank you.
That's Tammy Jackson with the Wisconsin Board for People with Developmental Disabilities. Coming up, the state recently distributed over $1.4 billion to local governments. Get an update from the League of Wisconsin Municipalities.
Shared revenue went up 2.3% this year. It'll go up 3.4% next year as the penny grows. As the economy grows, the partnership with local government grows.
That's ahead on Wisconsin Today. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret. Every year, Wisconsin shares revenue with 190 cities, 410 villages, and 72 counties, among other local units of government. This year, that amount adds up to more than $1.4 billion. The payments went out to communities in recent days. The money is used to help pay the bills. Local officials have long complained that the revenue isn't enough, and that forces them to raise property taxes. There's also some evidence that the money isn't distributed evenly. To help us understand how the state distributes this money and how local governments use it, we turn to Jerry DeShane. He's the executive director of the League of Wisconsin Municipalities. He talked to Kate Archer-Kent last week.
So $1.4 billion, that sounds like a lot of money, but it gets divided among almost 2,000 local governments. Is the amount that the state decided to give out this year more generous than in previous years? What do you see?
Yeah, the state lived up to its commitment to protect the penny. That's what we call it. In the last budget, Kate, you recall that the legislature and the governor agreed that they would set aside a penny of the sales tax for local government services. And as the economy grows, that penny gets more valuable, and they have stuck to their word. I'm very pleased that the governor and the legislature increased the amount of what we call shared revenue with local governments. They also increase transportation aids and a variety of other things. So yeah, the partnership is alive and well.
So there was that historic shared revenue legislation back in the summer of 2023 that increased that main source of state aid to municipalities, as you mentioned, shared revenue. has that cycle then kicked in sufficiently? Where are we at?
That's a good way to ask the question. So first of all, yeah, the cycle has kicked in. And what had been happening for two, depending on how you want to look at things, almost three decades before that, was the amount of shared revenue to local governments hadn't gone up. You know, there were more sales taxes being collected, more income taxes, but the piece that went to local governments was either frozen or declining for two or three decades. That big bill changed all of that. As I mentioned, the legislature and the governor said, we're going to set aside a penny of the sales tax that goes to local government. Well, this year was the first big test. Were we going to be able to sustain that commitment? And I'm happy to say that, yes, the legislature and the governor did. They absolutely stood up to their word and kept the full penny for local government operations. Specifically, shared revenue went up 2.3% this year. It'll go up 3.4% next year as the penny grows. As the economy grows, the partnership with local government grows. So I'm very happy at this stage of the game. We've reversed about 20 years of history.
Can you explain some of the different types of aid that fall under this heading of shared revenue?
Well, there are two that fall under the shared revenue banner. The first is shared revenue. It's also county and municipal aid is another term that we sometimes apply to that. Then there is what's called county and municipal supplemental aid. Without getting too deep into the weeds that would just drive your listeners crazy, Kate, what they did was they set up a different formula, because the old formula tended to favor older central cities. The new formula is kinder to small communities. So they just blended the two. Rather than throw out the old formula and come up with a new one, they have two separate pots, two different formulas. One favors one sort of city, the other favors another sort of city, village, and town. It's not a perfect system, but it works. There are a lot of other things that fall under the penny that, let me know when your listeners have fallen asleep here, Kate, but—
No, we like the weeds.
Payment for municipal services, payment for personal property taxes, which is something that went away a few years ago. There are a bunch of smaller items within there, but about two-thirds of the penny is shared revenue or supplemental aid.
Are municipalities restricted then in how they can use the money that the state gives them?
The supplemental, yes. The main portion, which is shared revenue, no. The supplemental, they have to prioritize the critical services, the first responder services, but also public works and roads. Again, in reality, those are the biggest parts of local budgets anyway. Mm-hmm. And then the last thing that I would be remiss if I didn't point out, that even though shared revenue is huge, it's not a majority of local funding. Local funding still comes for the most part from local property taxes. It's hard to put an average on it, but roughly 85% of local budgets are funded by property taxes, not shared revenue.
Okay, so even though that this is a big injection of funding, it's still the property taxes that remain the lion's share for most local governments and their communities.
Yep, love it or hate it, Wisconsin is still that, we're that one state in the nation that relies almost exclusively on property taxes as a local revenue source. And we realize that that's frustrating for property taxpayers, and perhaps at some point in the future we'll revisit that. But that is the way it's set up right now.
Okay, Jerry, in these weeds that we're in, what is the what is
you asked for it, Kate?
Yeah, no, here we go. We're in it. What is the state's expenditure restraint incentive program, and how much more aid can a community get from it?
I don't have the exact figures in front of me. It's a fraction. If shared revenue is, what's the number these days? About $1.4 billion. expenditure restraint doesn't add up to even $100 million. Mm. That is, it's an incentive payment. It matters. And every city or village or town is a little bit different in what they qualify for. But, you know, in many cases, it's one more firefighter or one more police officer. So it's important not to lose it. And for your listeners, what expenditure restraint basically says is as long as you keep your spending below the spending increase below the rate of inflation, you qualify for this. Well, given levy limits, which are about one third of inflation on average, for most communities, most of the time, that's not an issue. Every now and then they'll run into a big one-time road project or some other expense that puts them over the expenditure restraint limit for a year, but then they come back into the program.
We're talking about the tax revenues that Wisconsin shares with local governments. The State Revenue Department recently distributed over $1.4 billion in shared revenue and these property tax credits to local governments across the state. Jerry DeShane is with us, Executive Director of the League of Wisconsin Municipalities, to talk about shared revenue. Jerry, you know, is shared revenue growing in pace with property taxes?
Well, actually, it's growing faster than property taxes. Property taxes in Wisconsin are limited by what are called levy limits. And, you know, hold my hand, Kate, here we go into the weed patch again. But levy limits for municipalities are strictly tied to the amount of new construction that takes place in a city or village over the course of a year. I can't increase my spending if I'm the mayor of Privets, Wisconsin. I can't increase spending beyond the percentage increase caused by new construction. And if that doesn't make sense, I can explain it a little deeper. But that number in reality seldom comes to more than about one third of inflation. So property taxes have actually been losing ground to inflation, while shared revenue, since it's tied to the sales tax, which grows with the economy, has been doing a better job recently keeping up with inflation.
Can you then explain further how does this shared revenue affect property taxes for homeowners?
It depends on the community. Uh-huh. For the city of Middleton, let's pull that as an example. Middleton, down by Madison and Dane County, shared revenue is only 1% of their budget. So shared revenue, it matters, but it's 1%. It's not going to make property taxpayers live, die, cheer, or groan. But then you go down to Beloit, shared revenue is 49%. It's almost half of their budget. And this has to do with the old formula that was in place. So what happens to shared revenue in Beloit, their budget either sinks or swims, depending on what happened to shared revenue. In all cases, the challenge for the future, Kate, is we have to do something about levy limits, or we have to think about diversifying local revenue sources so that local governments can get fully plugged into the economy that they help to create.
There is the analysis from the Wisconsin Policy Forum and Wisconsin Watch, both finding that changes the legislature made to shared revenue benefited smaller communities much more than larger cities. And the analysis found that communities with fewer than 5,000 residents saw their aid jump by 200%. Cities got a more modest 25% bump. Does the formula then, and I know it's complex, does it tilt toward more rural places?
You know, Kate, I'm going to come out of this interview with a terrible case of poison ivy because you insist on tramping through the weeds. Okay. So I'm sorry. We beat that analogy to death now, haven't we?
I think we have, dutifully, yes.
Okay. But to your point, remember I talked about there's the shared revenue pot and there's the supplemental pot. Mm-hmm. The shared revenue pot is an older formula that's been frozen in place for 20 years. That formula favors older cities, specifically Milwaukee, Kenosha, Racine, Beloit, Green Bay, and disfavors small communities, very small population communities. The supplemental, which is the second pot of shared revenue, that actually favors small communities. The formula is skewed more to favor small communities. I would caution, and I've had this conversation with the folks over at Policy Forum and others, I would caution playing games with percentages, because while it's true that some small communities may have seen a 200% increase in their shared revenue, that went from, you know, maybe $2,000 to $6,000, which might buy them a couple more truckloads of salt in the winter, but that's about it. So it's kind of hard to just look at it from a percentage perspective. But I do have to say to both small and large communities, because shared revenue isn't the majority of anyone's budget, local budgets don't live and die by shared revenue. It's very important. But that local property tax levy is still the primary driver. And that one, frankly, is pinching just about everybody.
You know, Wisconsin's spring election is in April. Do you anticipate communities bringing more referendums and asking residents for more money by way of property tax levy increases?
Yes. Based on the conversations that we have with local leaders, conversations that I know they're having with their legislators, with the governor, with others, the sub-inflationary levy limit in Wisconsin, that cap that's keeping property taxes at one-third the rate of inflation, is forcing more communities. They've been cutting budgets, they've been combining services, but more and more of them will have to go to referendum starting in the spring. Yeah, you're going to see more.
Are there particular funding formula changes that the League advocates for?
We don't advocate for specific funding formula change. The League is an advocate for diversifying local revenue sources. Wisconsin is an outlier in that local governments really only have the property tax. It's a one-size-fits-all scheme that, quite frankly, property owners don't like, businesses don't like, and local governments don't like. We think there is room to talk about mixing up the revenue sources. What that mix would be, we're wide open to a good conversation on that. And quite frankly, we think the shared revenue agreement forms the basis for those conversations to take place in the future.
Oh, that's interesting. You find that that 2023 change and that increase really creates the backdrop for further conversations about a future, you know, that shared revenue could have a, you know, changes in the future.
Oh, I absolutely do. First of all, every time you have an opportunity to reach an agreement, a bipartisan agreement, and both bipartisan and beyond partisan, since local governments are nonpartisan, that helps set the stage for further conversations. Everyone involved in that shared revenue discussion knew that that was not the end of the conversation. They knew that there would have to be this conversation about property taxes. So yes, I'm both optimistic, but I'm also confident that the parties involved are developing a level of trust with one another. The Innovation Fund is out there, and we can talk about that perhaps some other day, that encourages local governments to collaborate, consolidate, and do more with the resources they have. All of those pieces are moving together to a future conversation.
Now, to more broadly on the horizon, the One Big Beautiful Bill Act that was signed by President Trump, it is going to make deep cuts to social services, you know, Medicaid, food assistance. Do you think will local governments feel a need to make up some of this funding?
Municipal governments don't generally provide a lot of social services. That's more of a county function in most places. However, having said that, if there are cuts in areas that affect homeless populations and local governments have a housing responsibility, yes, then they're going to have to step up. A lot of uncertainty about that, a lot of questions being asked. And the other thing is there's a lot of changes that seem to keep coming from Washington.
Such as tariffs, such as economic uncertainty. How does that affect the municipalities you work with? What are their gut feelings?
They are used to waiting for Washington and Madison to act and then seeing, okay, once you've acted, what do we have to deal with? So to a certain extent, they're used to uncertainty. It is challenging, particularly for our major cities, for cities that have a fairly large poor population, or for cities that won a federal grant and now are not sure if that federal grant's going to be funded or not. So there's uncertainty, but at the same time, as I said, local governments are both pragmatic. They're also pretty patient.
Jerry, appreciate the conversation. Thanks so much for joining us.
Kate, it's always a pleasure. Thank you.
Jerry DeShane is the executive director of the League of Wisconsin Municipalities. He talked to Kate Archer-Kent about shared revenue payments, the money Wisconsin sends back to local governments. The State Revenue Department recently distributed over $1.4 billion through this funding. Coming up, Wisconsin author shares the joy of hiking and hidden gems, the local parks and trails close to home.
Part of it is just the surprise in seeing a place that you thought you knew in a different light.
That's coming up next here on Wisconsin Today. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret. Last year, writer and master naturalist Andrea Debink set out to do 40 hikes throughout Dane County. It was research for her new guidebook called Urban Trails Madison. Along the way, she was struck by how few people would be out on some of those trails. In the guidebook, she shares what she learned about these hidden gems, and she offers advice for finding natural wonder in our own communities. We recently met up with Andrea for a hike at a local nature preserve I'd never been to, Owen Conservation Park on Madison's west side.
It's funny, I always thought this park was kind of hidden in plain sight, and it's become even more so over the years. I had a hard time seeing where to turn coming here today,
right,
just because like the sign's kind of hidden in the woods. So I kind of love how you're in the middle of, you know, residential neighborhoods in this city, but yet there's all of this nature right here.
It was an unseasonably cool day for the middle of the summer, low 70s, very nice. And at the start of the hike, there were no other people around besides Andrea and our crew from WPR. As we stepped into the wooded area, it was easy to forget just how close we were to buildings and roads and cars. Along the way, Andrea helped us ID some flowers, trees, and bird calls. We did get to see one group of regulars at the park, though.
And sometimes back here in these woods, you'll come across the local troop of turkeys that live in here. Kind of find them throughout this park, but they like to hang out in this area. I've seen them before.
After spending some time exploring the park, I sat down with Andrea at a picnic table to talk more about what she learned while writing her guidebook. I started by asking her about some of the big takeaways from her year out on the trails.
You know, the biggest takeaway for me was just how many trails are here. I think when my publisher first asked me to include 40 trails, I thought, are there even 40 trails in the Madison area that I could include? And there definitely was. And that was really the biggest surprise, to just realize how many hiking opportunities we have in a fairly small area.
What are the joys? What's the special thing about finding that local hidden gem of a trail?
I think part of it is just the surprise in seeing a place that you thought you knew in a different light. One of the biggest hidden gems for me was the Grady Tract. which is one of the hikes in my book. And, you know, I've driven past that land so many times on the Beltline, and to suddenly, you know, finally hike it and realize, wow, there's this entire world hidden within this place that I thought I knew pretty well. There was just a lot of joy in that, to realize that there's still a lot to discover in a place that you know really well.
How do you discover trails? Because like you say, you could drive by these things. There might be a tiny sign. What was the discovery process like?
Right. Well, it helps that I've lived in Madison for more than 20 years. So I'm pretty familiar with at least what the parks are and where they are. When it came to creating my list of the trails that I wanted to hike, I really went back and looked at the parks that I knew. And then, you know, took a lot closer look at their maps and went to visit them to see what the hiking was actually like. And I think, you know, there were parks that I had been aware of for years, but didn't realize that there were trails there that you could make a really good hike out of. So part of that was just drawing on the knowledge that I've had from living here and hiking here for a while. But then, of course, there were limits to that. So then I had to, dig around online, and also just go to like the Dane County Parks website, the Madison City Parks, to see what kind of information they had about hiking.
Now, in early COVID in particular, with kids looking for outdoor things to do, we did a lot of look at the map. Hey, this part's green. What is it?
Yes.
And sometimes it was great. It was like this. There's cool trails. Nobody knew about it. And sometimes it's more of a like a wildlife preserve, mainly oriented toward hunting, say, more than hiking. What kind of advanced work do you recommend people do when they trek off into that own unknown local nature area?
Yeah, you know, I've known people that have used that method as well, like look for the green spaces on the map and then go there. I would suggest before you go there, looking up to see what type of natural area it is. Because like you said, we have a lot of green spaces, a lot of natural areas, city and county owned land, but not all of it is open to the public in terms of hiking, and not all of them have access, whether it's, you know, parking or trails. So I would say if you're doing that route, to find out the name of the place. And then, honestly, just do a simple Google search, because you can usually find out, like, is this a state natural area that offers hiking? Is it a county park? Is it a city park? Or also, you can pick up a hiking guide, too, and actually see what sort of trails are available as well.
Do you like to go back to the same park again and again over the course of a year and see it evolve, see it change with the seasons?
Yeah, that's something that I love to do. And something that I did before I even started working on this project. One of my favorite parks in recent years to do that with is Elver Park on the west side of Madison, because for many years I lived pretty close to that park, and it was easy to just kind of walk over there and then link up to one of the hiking trails and walk through it. And it's a different park in every season, which I think is something you can say of most of our parks. Right now we're at Owen Park, and things are, you know, just growing like crazy, and the plants are so tall you can hardly see over them. You come back in the fall, come back in the winter, it's a totally different landscape. So, you know, you're always seeing something new. Yeah, so that bird we're hearing, that's a robin. The last time I was here, there were indigo buntings, and that's a call that I'm still learning. Mm-hmm. The wood peewee, another new one for me. And then a couple of red belly woodpeckers.
We're talking to Andrea Debink, master naturalist and author of a new guidebook called Urban Trails Madison. When we were out on the trail just now, Andrea, we had little sub-themes. We were trying to spot flowers and insects and birds and whatnot. Do you sometimes just set out, like today, well, I know you do guided bird tours, but on your own, do you set out to say, today I'm looking for blank?
Usually I'm looking for plants. Mm-hmm. Though I'd say the two things that I'm looking for the most would be either birds or plants, because those are the things you're going to come across most often, especially, like I said, because of the way the landscape just changes through the seasons. When it comes to plants in particular, you're always going to be seeing something different. The flowers that we're seeing right now, they're not going to be blooming in another month or so, but there'll be other things blooming that you can look at.
What about these purple ones here? Let's
look at that one. Oh, that is the American bellflower. A lot of people are familiar with creeping bellflower, which looks similar, but the flowers are more bell-shaped. That is actually a plant that people try to get rid of in their yards.
I know
it spreads everywhere. I have it in my yard right now.
this is not that plant. It's the American bellflower, which is actually the native plant that's good that you want to keep there. And its flowers are actually more star-shaped than the invasive.
Yep. Okay, now this is, we're going to see this everywhere, but this is bee balm or wild bergamot. And it's a native plant. It's a good plant that you want around. If you kind of look up information about this plant, some people will say that it's used to make Earl Grey tea, and that's not right. It's actually, it's called bergamot because of the similar smell that it has to the wild, or not the wild, the bergamot citrus, which is used in Earl Grey tea. So actually, if you take a leaf and just kind of rub it, it smells a little bit like Earl Grey.
I don't really like Earl Grey.
Yeah.
Much, I'll still smell it. Oh, totally. Yeah. I can see that.
I always love it if I can spot a mammal too, because you just don't see, you know, larger mammals as often in these parks. I think maybe the largest animal I've seen has been a coyote, and I've seen them several times, but they're just a lot more secretive and have their times of day where they like to come out.
And any good mammal wildlife here? We've heard about the turkeys and some of the other birds.
Yes, I mean, I've never seen anything here myself, but
doesn't
I know.
It seems like a deer sort of place.
No, I mean, though, deer can surprise you because they're kind of that species that likes to hang out on the margins of,
right,
like, developed areas. I haven't seen any deer here. I know that people see foxes, coyotes. I lived on the near west side of Madison for years and years, and I saw so many coyotes during that time. And there's actually a project at the UW that studies Madison's coyotes and foxes and how those populations interact with one another. So there are a lot of them around.
Now, something striking here, and we're here on a weekday, but one mammal I haven't seen a ton of here is humans. There are some, us and some others. I think you got a mosquito right in your forehead.
Yes.
There you go. Got it.
It's that time.
Yes, we've got our favorite parks, our favorite state parks in Wisconsin, and yes, they can be pretty crowded.
Yeah.
Is that one of the benefits of finding these lesser-known parks, that you have a lot of elbow room?
It is, yes. I personally love that because I love, when I get into nature, just to have kind of space and a little more quiet, a little more freedom to kind of just move at my own pace and not have a lot of extra noise. So, I mean, I love some of our, you know, more popular state parks in Wisconsin. One of my favorites is Peninsula State Park in Door County, and then also Devil's Lake, but they definitely offer a different experience in terms of crowds or noise and that sort of thing. So yeah, a big draw to going to these places is just being able to have a little more space and quiet.
Another joy I find with urban parks and communities is, yes, it can be fun to be out in the middle of nowhere in nature, but there's a special kind of joy in having this pocket of nature and solitude and green in the middle of a populated area. Is that part of what appeals to you?
Yeah. The thing that I love about, you know, our parks here in Madison and the trails that I was researching is just how accessible they are in terms of, you know, they're really close to a lot of people's everyday lives and everyday orbits. You don't have to plan a big road trip to visit them or block out a whole weekend to visit them. You could stop by after work or before work or lunch break or, you know, just part of a day on a Saturday. It doesn't take a huge commitment to still experience a lot of the beauty that's here.
Now, how about accessibility? I assume there's a wide variety for people with strollers, people in wheelchairs,
right,
or my knee is bad this week and I can't do anything too rugged. How do we suss out how accessible that walk is going to be for us?
Yeah, that's a great question. And something that we tried to address in the book right up in the beginning, I highlight some of the trails that might be more accessible from a physical perspective. If you're looking for a path that's more level, you know, a less steep grade, and I pull those out, but then also do so in the knowledge that accessibility is something that people have to determine for themselves too. And, you know, it kind of depends on the person and what their physical abilities and needs are. But that is something that we try to highlight. And there are some good places in Madison, some trails in the books that are pretty much, you know, physically accessible for a lot of different people. Also, I think in terms of accessibility, it's important to talk about how people are able to get to these places. So one thing that we tried to do in the book is every trail to provide how you get public transportation there in addition to driving directions. Because it's one thing to have these parks available for us in the city, but if you need to use public transportation to get there, that can be a barrier as well. So we've tried to provide that information where possible.
And we mentioned the changing seasons. We have lucked into being here on a lovely 70-ish degree day, gentle breeze, no rain.
Yes.
Do you, even in the winter, are you out on some of these paths?
Oh, yes, absolutely. I'm a summer person. I love summer. But I've discovered, you know, winter has its beauty too. And I think getting outdoors, no matter the weather and no matter the season, actually helps your mental health and your emotional well-being. I know it helps mine. One of my favorite memories actually was a time that my husband and I went hiking at the Madison School Forest, which is also in the book. And we were there on a day when the wind chill was 30 below. So literally no one else was out there, but it was still a really beautiful hike because it had snowed recently. So, you know, you have to prepare and make sure you're wearing the right sort of clothing and have the right sort of supplies. But I mean, just to get out in the sun and see the snow was definitely worth it.
So we're hiking through nature. It's urban, and we may feel like we could do different things than we would out in nature. But what are good ethics, ways to take care of the land? And maybe, you know, the neighbors are living right there, too.
Right. Yeah. You know, I think anytime you go outdoors, whether you're hiking or doing anything else, it's important to just follow the principles of Leave No Trace. The Leave No Trace principles were developed by the Leave No Trace Center for Outdoor Ethics a couple of decades ago. And I find that they're really good guidelines for how you should interact with the outdoors. A lot of it's just, you know, stay on the trail. Don't try to go off trail or forge new trails through the woods. Don't litter. Bring your garbage out with you. Don't pick or forage unless you're in a place where you actually are allowed to do that.
I just saw some ripe raspberries. I did not eat them. No eating here.
And I think even beyond that, Leave No Trace, I love the whole idea of leave it better than you found it, which is also kind of a popular ethic that people are starting to follow. And I think something that you can do along those lines is, you know, bring a bag with you and pick up trash that you see along the way. One thing that I've noticed about these trails in city environments is they often do have a lot of trash that either people left there or it blew in through a storm. So if you can be a part of leaving it better than you found it, you can make it a better place for everybody.
And can you leave us with some encouragement for people wherever they are in the state to look at that map and ask around and maybe find that guidebook and find that local park that they didn't know about?
Yeah, you know, I think that's important for everybody to do. And I would encourage people to do that close to home, wherever they're located, because I think you'd probably be surprised to find the trails and the opportunities to get outdoors that are near you. And that was my experience. Like I said, I lived in Madison for 20 plus years, and I'm just discovering places that were within a few miles of where I was doing my everyday life. So I would definitely encourage other people to do that.
Andrea, thanks again for joining us today.
Thanks for having me. This is great.
That was Andrea Debink, author of a new guidebook called Urban Trails Madison. We met up with her recently at Olin Conservation Park in Madison, where I got a crash course in identifying local birds and plants and not picking the raspberries. Do you have a local hidden gem park or trail that you love? Maybe in your own community, tell us about it. Email wisconsintoday@wpr.org. That's wisconsintoday@wpr.org. Tomorrow on the show, we'll take a look at national job numbers and try to get a handle on what things look like here in Wisconsin. And you can get us started. We want to hear your perspective right now on the job market. If you're looking for a job, what is that market looking like for you? Did you just get a job? How long did it take? If you make decisions on hiring for your business or other organization, are you adding staff, thinking about layoffs, holding steady, having trouble finding workers? We'd love to hear your thoughts and share them as part of that conversation. Email now, wisconsintoday@wpr.org. That's wisconsintoday@wpr.org. You can also call and leave a voice message or text us. Either way, that number is 888-642-0232. Wisconsin Today producers include Avery Lee Rogers, Joe Tarr, and Rochelle Wilson. Our technical directors are Sarah Hopeful and Lee Rayburn. Learn more about us at wpr.org/Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to WPR News.